Funding for Smart Talk is provided by Capital Blue Cross. For 80 years, Capital Blue Cross has offered products that provide peace of mind and promote good health, focused on creating a healthier future for our communities through innovations like its Capital Blue Health and Wellness Centers that provide in-person service and inspire healthy living. Capital Blue Cross is behind you for whatever lies ahead. More information is at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross. Live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by UPMC Pinnacle, bringing quality care to your community through Harrisburg, Community Osteopathic, West Shore, Carlisle, Hanover, Lancaster, Lititz, and Memorial Hospitals. More information is available at upmcpinnacle.com.
Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. The opioid and heroin crisis that has wreaked devastation on much of the country and Pennsylvania in the past few years grew as people living in the suburbs and rural areas from every economic background began abusing opioids and heroin. The new opioid user was from every ethnic and racial group, but was most often thought to be young. Think again. Nearly 42,000 Americans over the age of 45 died of opioid overdoses in 2016. That's about 42% of all opioid deaths. Talking about opioid addiction and death in older Pennsylvanians on the first part of today's program, joining us, Pennsylvania Secretary of Aging, Teresa Osborne. Secretary Osborne, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Also joining us today, Dr. Ming Wang. He's an addiction medicine physician who oversees the Older Adults Unit in Women's Care at Karen Treatment Centers. Dr. Wang, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Scott. Pleasure to be here.
If you have a question or a comment, 1-800-729-7532 is the number to call, or you can send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. Secretary Osborne, let me start with you. Those numbers probably surprise a lot of people, but give us a sense of how serious the opioid addiction problem is amongst those over the age of 45 in Pennsylvania.
You know, as you indicated, Scott, so much attention is paid to the opioid crisis, and rightfully so. But when it comes to older adults, age 45 and older, and for Pennsylvania, that has nearly 3 million individuals age 65 and older, we realize in the older population that this epidemic, this misuse and abuse of prescription drugs in particular, is underreported, undertreated, undiagnosed. And we need to really ensure that we're making as good and as effective policy decisions as possible to ensure that our older Pennsylvanians have access to treatment and a pathway to recovery.
Why is it underdiagnosed?
Well, Dr. Wang can certainly speak to that much better than I could, considering his background in the field. However, from our lens, from a public health and social and human service perspective, you know, often it's stigmatized. You know, folks focused attention on the opioid crisis to younger individuals as opposed to older individuals. And sometimes physicians don't know the questions to ask, don't know the symptoms to look for. Sometimes the same symptoms that are seen in an individual who is abusing or misusing prescription drugs are attributed to depression. We have a lot of work to do, and thankfully we're doing it with medical professionals like Dr. Wang and also our own physician consultant, Dr. David Glinsky, who had worked with Dr. Levine at the Department of Health to work on prescribing guidelines for geriatric prescribers. So there's an awful lot of space for us to concentrate our efforts in order to ensure that we're educating, you know, prescribers, our physicians, and also working with pharmacists and academic detailing, as we referred to it, as to ensure that we're looking at prescribing practices and doing education with physicians right in their offices, you know, in terms of looking at this issue of prescribing pain medications and looking for alternatives to that as well.
I just wanted to clarify something, and this probably is not a surprise, but when we're talking about the dependency on opioids, we're not, for the most part, talking about heroin in this age group, correct?
Not typically in this age group, no, but it's not an impossibility, but most of our efforts are concentrated on the misuse and abuse of prescription drugs, in particular painkillers.
Why isn't this getting more attention?
You know, from my particular lens of life, working in this field of aging for my career, you know, there's a stigma attached to it. Most families, most individuals, regardless of age, truly, you know, are afraid to say, I have a problem, I need help. But truly, this addiction, this misuse and abuse of prescription drugs can impact anyone at any age. And with a particular lens of life focusing on older Pennsylvanians, we need to address that stigma. We need to ensure them that a pathway to recovery is possible and that they can live and age well right here in Pennsylvania with support and access to treatments and services. And that's a major goal of the Wolf administration, is to ensure that we break out of those silos and that we can ensure that older Pennsylvanians indeed have access to substance use treatment and access to services and supports.
Let's talk about those treatments. Dr. Wang, we know that everyone is different, and this crisis has affected everyone in a different way. But when an older person, and by older, I think we can pretty much agree on 45 and older. Is that what we would call older? I know a lot of people wouldn't like that, me included. But someone 45 and older, is there a typical patient that you see? I mean, how do they present when they come to the Karen centers for treatment?
Well, Scott, when we talk about the older adult population, generally we're talking about the baby boomer populations.
Okay.
That's the population.
So we are talking 40, older than 45.
Than 45, that's
right.
Correct, Scott. Baby boomer generation, that's those people born between 1946 and 1964. And we also see people who are born before that generation, and they're considered the silent generation, which is people born between 1925 and 1945. So that's a particular group that we're looking at. The statistics coming out of NIH and SAMHSA, they're essentially referring to that population because there are unique challenges to that population that render some a little bit more difficult to identify, like the Secretary has stated, as well as it adds to the complications of treatment in addiction. And so that is a population that we do see quite a bit at Karen treatment centers, but not always that population. There are people who are younger as well that present unique challenges that needs to be addressed.
So it almost sounds like there's a donut hole. You said that it's not completely where there are no people at the age of 45 or so that are coming in. But at the same time, it sounds as if we have those younger people and then those people over 50 or maybe even older than that.
That is correct, Scott. What we're looking at is not necessarily the age. We're also looking at the unique challenges in the older adult population and perhaps even the younger population. The challenges that I speak of, including difficulty in diagnosing the substance use disorder, and then once that is diagnosed, the challenges that presents to effectively treat, and that includes co-occurring issues. Those are any issues that might interfere with their effective treatment and recovery. That may include medical illnesses, mental health issues, life issues, as well as prior trauma that perhaps has never been addressed.
See, and that's kind of what I was picturing here, is that these treatment, or at least the diagnosis, would be a little bit of a challenge, or more than a little bit of a challenge, because when people reach that age, we are experiencing so many, or many of us are experiencing so many other physical changes, physical ailments. So how do you nail down that there's actually a dependency, an addiction to opioids going on?
The symptoms and signs of addiction oftentimes mimic common medical illnesses, and there lies one of the problems in accurately identifying substance use disorder. As people age, they're likely to incur more medical illnesses and require more medications. And the symptoms of the medical illnesses, as well as the effect from the medications, oftentimes may mimic addiction and vice versa. So the pictures could be very clouded. And when the older adults go to their physicians for a complaint, for an illness, oftentimes the physician's looking to diagnose a medical condition rather than thinking addiction. And so that complicates the picture, that perhaps deters from diagnosing of the substance use disorder.
What ailments, what physical disorders does addiction mimic most often?
Addiction can mimic many different illnesses. For example, someone with a coronary artery disease, heart disease, who might have a failing heart or a weak heart, they may feel tired, lethargic, lack of energy. They oftentimes are sedentary. They don't want to move very much. Their lifestyle has changed. They're not doing as much as they used to do because of their heart condition. And so just those symptoms may mimic being addicted to a substance, which could present just like that.
You know, Secretary, something I'm thinking about with my own family members and their situations. Often we're talking about people who are widows, widowers, whose children have left home or are now adults. So many of these older adults are by themselves and often don't have people who would recognize that there are changes going on. And I would have to imagine that addiction, substance addiction disorder would be down on the list of things they would suspect too. But that has to be a unique situation as well.
You know, isolation in our senior population is a great concern. And when you don't have that daily contact with family, perhaps they've moved out of the area and you're not seeing them every day, it's hard to notice those day-to-day changes, which is why at local community levels, we encourage, you know, anybody that touches the life of an older Pennsylvanian, whether it's your, you know, your mailman, it's your fireman, your policeman, your pharmacist, your bank teller. You know, it's really education of the entire community, where we live, where we work, where we play, where we pray, in order to ensure that folks can look for changes in an individual. You know, the two buckets, so to say, that you were speaking of earlier, of those baby boomers, of which we have an awful lot of baby boomers across our country, 10,000 people, Americans every day turning the age of 65, and that phenomenon going to continue for the next 12 years. So we have baby boomers who are bringing the disease of addiction, lifelong addiction, into their golden years. So we need to ensure that we're prepared for them. But then the second bucket that you just referred to are late onset users, as we refer to them as. It's individuals who, as Dr. Wang just mentioned, are dealing with stresses of life, whether it's their own medical condition, the loss of a loved one, a child who has come under the ravages of opioid abuse, grandparents raising their grandchildren due to the opioid crisis. Even a good positive thing, such as a retirement, can lead someone into having more free time that they don't know what to do with, and that leads them to more opportunity to drink without consequences for their behavior, for example. So those are scenarios that are quite common across age spectrums, but in older Pennsylvanians, we need to ensure that we're looking out for each other, and that when we do see a problem, that we're not afraid to say, hey, you know, there's help, you know, let us reach out to you. Family interventions, you mentioned your own family, my family too, exposed to this crisis during the years, and that family dynamic is so important, and friends and family who can then say, wait a minute, let's stop and take a look at this bigger picture, bring that team together that's going to have a conversation to say, we want to help you, we want you to live and age well, we want you to be healthy, and we can get you the assistance and access to treatment and services that you need.
But how do you get past that stigma, though? I mean, you both have talked about that a little bit, that you said that someone who comes into contact with the person on a regular basis, like the mailman, like the police officer, you know, a neighbor or something like that, I would imagine that's a pretty difficult conversation to have, to say to someone, hey, how long have you been taking those painkillers? Do you think that maybe you've been taking them too long or that it's having an impact on your life?
Yeah, that is very true, Scott. There's a stigma attached to addiction in the older adults. You got to remember that in this generation, there are very stoic and private people. They like to keep to themselves, like to keep the private business to themselves. So there is a certain rigidity to this, and they tend not to like to be looked at as a drug addict or an alcoholic. And oftentimes I hear my patients tell me, I take this as prescribed by my doctor. And that is That is oftentimes their way of telling me that I am not a drug addict. But that may be very true, Scott. Oftentimes in this population, they take their medications as prescribed by their doctor, but that does not mean that they do not have substance use disorder, because that substance that they are being prescribed is causing harm.
If you would like to ask a question or make a comment about today's topic, the first segment of today's program, we're talking about opioid use in older Pennsylvanians, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. And today, as part of WITF's Transforming Health Project, to learn more about opioid addiction plus a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health, From Policy to Personal Choices. We're taking a comprehensive look at today's health system online at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, Penn State Health, and WellSpan Health. Our guest today, Pennsylvania Secretary of Aging Teresa Osborne and Dr. Ming Wang. He's an addiction medicine physician who oversees the Older Adults Unit in Women's Care at Karen Treatment Centers. 1-800-729-7532. All right. Even though it may be a surprise, the number of older people who do have a dependency on opioids, it probably is not a surprise in how that happens. And Dr. Wang, just what you described. Most people are going to the doctor for a bad back, arthritis, something like that. They're prescribed a painkiller. So that brings up the role of physicians in this, and whether there are too many prescriptions to painkillers, whether there are too many written, how they're monitored, all those things. You often hear young people who became addicted to opioids, went on to heroin, say, well, I started the painkillers because I didn't think they were addictive. Nobody told me that. Well, we know that now, that that's not the case. But Secretary Osborne, the doctors have a role here, and the state, obviously we've enacted some laws here recently to monitor prescriptions written. But when it comes to older people, again, if the doctor's not thinking about an opioid addiction and thinking about these other ailments, it would seem to be more of a challenge.
It absolutely is a challenge for a physician who's treating anyone of any age. But when it comes to the older population, we are taking steps through the governor's disaster declaration, as well as the work that we do on a daily basis. Pennsylvania has a very robust pharmaceutical assistance benefit program for individuals aged 65 and older,
the PACE program.
And through that program for many years, and now we're able to increase our efforts because of the monies received through the 21st Century Cures Grant in order to look at prescribing practices. So through the prescription drug monitoring program, we can look at prescribing practices of physicians who are more inclined to be caring for the geriatric population, because we can look at it pretty quickly through the PACE platform. So we are looking at those prescribing guidelines. We are ensuring that we're sharing information across our sister agencies, as well as with other entities that can help, educate physicians and working with the medical community, obviously, to say, look, you really need to be paying close attention to prescription guidelines for geriatric patients. These are recommendations that we're offering to you. These are alternative treatments to pain management. How do we ensure that we're educating physicians is something that Dr. Wang and I were talking about, prior to coming in for this interview, and certainly a dialogue that we'll continue to ensure that for the next generation of physicians, as well as the current generation of physicians, that we have opportunity in Pennsylvania to ensure that we are giving the best education and awareness outlook for physicians who are going to be entrusted to care for the older adults of today, as well as the older adults for tomorrow.
I hope this question isn't coming out of left field, but Pennsylvania is ramping up its medical marijuana program. And amongst the conditions that people can legally be prescribed, and I know prescribed maybe is not the right word, but medical marijuana is for pain and pain management. Are there older Pennsylvanians who would benefit from medical marijuana rather than opioids?
Let me answer that question, Scott.
And that's not out of left field, I hope.
that is a very good question, Scott. But let's first consider these substances most commonly involved in addiction in the older adults, and that's alcohol, opioids, pain medications, and sedative hypnotics. Sedative hypnotics being medications such as Valium, Xanax, Klonopin, and that type of medication. So those are the three most common types of medications involved in addiction in the older adult population. And the opioids and the sedative hypnotics are mostly prescribed by physicians.
Alcohol obviously isn't.
that is correct. And so these are legitimately prescribed medications that eventually begin to cause harm. So the question is, why are these medications prescribed? What are the ailments that these medications were prescribed for? Most commonly, opioids are prescribed for chronic pain conditions. And in our experience is in this field is that we believe that there are better options of treating chronic pain conditions than opioid medications. Opioid medications almost never work in chronic pain conditions. Now, Scott, I'm not talking about acute pain conditions like a broken arm or car accident injuries, things like that, nor am I talking about terminal illnesses. I'm talking about chronic pain conditions, back pain, joint pains, and things like that. So we need to explore better options of treating these type of pain conditions, because opioid analgesics, pain medications, they do not work very well. There are only temporary measures and not permanent solutions. And our experience at Caron Treatment Centers is that we manage chronic pain conditions and we do it fairly well without use of any opioids. And that's, I believe, where it's the direction that we need to head towards. From the medical standpoint.
I saw a headline yesterday about people abusing over-the-counter drugs. What about that?
Over-the-counter medications, many of them are abusable, Scott, and because it's all about the function of the midbrain in a part of the brain that we call the limbic system, and frankly, the limbic system is about feelings, obtaining a certain feelings, changing a certain feelings. So, given that. Control substances like opioids and sedative hypnotics and alcohol as well will change the feelings of the individual through the limbic system. And so given that, many of the over-the-counter medications would do exactly that, would change how a person feels. And that may be enough for the person to start taking that medications over-the-counter in a habitual manner.
Okay, so we only have a few minutes left. I want to thank both of you for being on the program today for this very important issue. What kind of advice would you leave with, not just our older listeners, but family members, everyone else, when it comes to paying attention to this in older Pennsylvanians, that they are not dependent on, well, we'll throw alcohol into that as well, Dr. Wang, alcohol, and the opioids. What kind of advice would you give people?
I would tell the families not to dismiss anything that they see in their older adults that might be concerning to them. Whether their older adult family members are becoming more sedentary, they're not participating in what they used to enjoy doing, golfing, socializing, things like that. They seem to be isolating more. They appear to be more fatigued and lethargic and sleeping more. I would tell the families not to ignore those symptoms. Certainly, they need to be addressed from a medical standpoint, but never to dismiss those symptoms as merely growing old or perhaps an underlying medical conditions. They must be aware that potentially the medications may be causing many of these symptoms, and always to go to the doctor's appointment with their older family members and see what the doctor has to say, and help their older adult family members discuss their conditions with the doctor.
Secretary Osborne.
You know, to build off what Dr. Wang just mentioned, you know, I would encourage that also. And then I would also say not to be afraid to talk about it, not to be afraid to ask those tough questions, and then to encourage our older Pennsylvanians that, you know, regardless of age, you know, resources and assistance are available. And we're putting a lot of effort right now in the Wolf administration to ensure that at the Department of Aging and through our local area agencies on aging that cover the 67 counties of the Commonwealth, working collaboratively with the local drug and alcohol community through the single county authorities to ensure that anyone can call 1-800-622-HELP, the Get Help Now number, in order to provide ready assistance for them, in order to ensure that they can access treatment, they can find a provider, and that funding isn't the barrier to ensure that they can get access to inpatient or outpatient treatment. You know, there is a pathway to recovery, and we want all Pennsylvanians to live and age well, and we need to do it collaboratively.
And to follow what the Secretary just said, Scott, I just want to say that we feel that at any age, it's worth it. To get treatment is worth it.
And something you didn't, you just mentioned, Secretary, that we didn't talk about, and that was money, because we do know a lot of older people, if they're on fixed incomes especially, but as you said, it's not a problem. Secretary of Aging Teresa Osborne, Dr. Megan Wang with Karen Treatment Centers, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you,
Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
Smart Talk is supported by Capital Blue Cross, providing health care coverage accepted by doctors and specialists in all 50 states. More information is available at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by Pinnacle Health Spine Institute, part of UPMC Pinnacle, offering a complete range of services to diagnose and treat your spine condition. More information is available at upmcpinnacle.com/spine.
Welcome back to Smart Talk. We are in the midst of WITF's Roses campaign, with Valentine's Day coming up on Wednesday, and WITF's multimedia news director Tim Lambert joins me. Tim, I was just thinking that, you know, it's a hard turn to go from talking about something that serious of opioid addiction in older Pennsylvanians, and in the second part of the program, we'll be talking about concentration camps, to, you know, talking about roses and Valentine's Day, something very happy. But it's a good example of what we do in Smart Talk all the time, addressing serious issues. And that's part of, I think, one of the reasons that there are so many people that do support the WITF.
Yeah, absolutely. The news and information you hear each and every day hopefully helps keep you informed, helps educate you, helps provide the context that you need to understand issues better. And Smart Talk brings that to you each and every day. Of course, Valentine's Day is tomorrow, and this is a chance for you to show your support for Smart Talk by making a contribution at WITF.org/roses. And when you make that contribution, you can send a dozen red or rainbow roses, if that contribution is $125, anywhere in the U.S. You have until 2 p.m. today to get those national orders in. And so far today, 11 states are receiving roses from WITF listeners. A half dozen red roses and rainbow roses, $100 contribution. If you want to do the mic drop, that's a 2 dozen red roses and a base for $250. You can add a stuffed bear for $10. It's a chance now to show your support and your appreciation for that someone in your life who's had an influence on you, who is there for you each and every day. Maybe someone who looks after your kids. Maybe someone who has shoveled your driveway throughout the winter. Maybe someone who mows your lawn in the summer. Maybe someone who brings you a meal each and every day. Think about those people who have an impact on your life and make that contribution at 1-800-233-9483. It's World Radio Day, Scott.
Oh, is it?
It's Fasnacht Day, and it's also Galentine's Day. So there's a lot going on for people.
And Ash Wednesday.
That's Ash Wednesday
tomorrow.
Yeah. So Lent starts. It's a chance now to show your support for public radio at 1-800-233-9483 or WITF.org/roses.
Tim, I'll be talking to you again in a few minutes.
Sure.
You're listening to WITF, your home for NPR News and all things considered. I am Scott Lamar. When most people picture concentration camps, their first thoughts are of Nazi Germany and the Holocaust. Unfortunately, those concentration camps in Europe before and during World War II are not the only examples of people suffering in captivity because of their religion, race, sexual orientation, ethnicity, or political beliefs. That's according to renowned author Andrea Pitzer in her latest book, One Long Night,
A Global History of Concentration Camps. Andrea Pitzer joins us on today's Smart Talk to discuss the book that Smithsonian Magazine named one of the 10 best history books of 2017. Ms. Pitzer, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on.
Andrea Pitzer appears at Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg this Saturday at 3:30 p.m., so we wanted to mention that as well. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. Andrea Pitzer, I have to admit that whenever I talk about your book to someone, I've talked about to a lot of people and mentioned it on Facebook, right away they assume that it was about Nazi Germany and Europe before and during World War II. Why does everyone make that assumption?
Well, because I think that the Nazis really took it into this other universe of bending their entire, you know, materiel, even during wartime, and so much of their population and so much land to the destruction of both the Jews that they encountered in Poland and in other occupied territories and in Germany, and also the Roma and Sinti, which used to be called Gypsies. I think that just sort of took it into this whole other place, and so that's what sticks in our mind. But it's important to remember that that's not how it all started, because, of course, knowing how it started can help us think about how it might happen again.
And I want to talk about how it started in just a few minutes, but why write about concentration camps?
Well, I actually, when I was working on my first book, which was about Vladimir Nabokov, the guy who wrote Lolita, his brother had died in a German concentration camp, and I wanted to get a basic backgrounder on camps, and I looked around and realized that there was no English language history of how they came into the world. And so after actually visiting the camp where his brother had died, I started to think that it was important to write one.
Well, I have to say that, you know, this is not a light read, and what one could come away with a sense of just how cruel human beings can be may even make them question their faith in humanity. I mean, there has been, and this, we're talking just over the last 100 plus years or so since the 1890s, people have been very cruel and brutal.
Well, it's really important. I mean, that's absolutely true, and certainly the book explores that in depth. But I think it's important to recognize that people have to be trained to do this. This is not just some inevitable part of human nature. This is governments or parties training people to accept it. It doesn't happen spontaneously. You really have to polarize the society, and you have to then paint one or more groups as some kind of threat to the nation or to national security. So the good news of all this is that it doesn't just happen on its own, you know, so therefore it's preventable. We haven't necessarily done a great job of preventing it, of course.
And you touched on it, but I wanted to get you to clarify, what is your definition of a concentration camp?
It is, for the purposes of this book, it's a pretty broad one. It's mass detention of civilians without trial, usually because of their ethnicity, their religion, race, or political identification. So anytime you take a whole group of regular people, so this is not POW camps, which have a much longer history. This is when a government or party decides we're going to pick up all these civilians, knowing they're not necessarily guilty of anything, they may not have fought against us, but on a preventive basis, we're locking them away from the rest of society.
The introduction of the book and the last chapter focus on Guantanamo. Many Americans probably don't think of today's Guantanamo Bay, where suspected terrorists are housed, as a concentration camp. Why is today's Gitmo a concentration camp in your mind?
Well, when I first started the book, my plan was to kind of go to Gitmo at the end, which I did go twice, but to go to Gitmo at the end of the book and to sort of say how it was and wasn't like these camps. But what I found was, after doing all the research for the book, it actually continues a tradition we saw in South America in the 70s and 80s, and in which you had torture as a part of the detention program really integrated into it, in which you had black sites where people were tortured. And it even sort of surprised me that it did fit into the way that the camps have evolved in modern times. Now, to be clear, post 9/11, we had a real need to find those people who were involved with the attack. But instead of using these traditional law enforcement interrogation tactics and detention that's authorized by domestic and international law, we built a whole global detention network, including these black sites and the torture program. It could have been done legitimately and under rule of law, but that is just, it's not the way we went. And it was partly a panic response, and it was partly that we had some of these institutions in place that that we could then take to the next step like this. Guantanamo has held detainees for decades, in other words.
As you write in the book, these decisions by the Bush administration, for the most part, after 9/11 in 2001, that these places were placed on foreign soil for a reason and not in the United States. And even though Guantanamo is an Air Force base, it is not considered American soil.
It's been a naval base since the 1890s, and so we already had a presence there. We'd already held a lot of Haitian refugees there that had been trying to get to the U.S. during different calamities in their country. And so we had some of the technical things that we needed in place there. But you're right, the decision to bring people there was deliberately to keep them outside of U.S. constitutional protections. And it's also important to note, and this is a big part of why it ended up in my book, a lot of the people who were brought had nothing to do with anything. They were not vetted. They were not checked. They were not, because they were not given these protections that they would have had under the Geneva Convention, which would have helped figure out that some of them didn't belong in detention or under interrogation in any format. We had a really mixed population of some people who likely did exactly what we thought they did, and a number of people who were just people grabbed off the street or turned in by neighbors for a bounty. So that's how you get that sort of civilian aspect that makes it part of the concentration camp phenomenon.
When you say a number of people, could you place a percentage on the people who were sent to Gitmo that didn't belong there because they weren't involved in any kind of terrorism activities or conspiracies?
There's at this point, to untie that knot and figure out a hard number, it would be impossible, but certainly hundreds.
Hundreds. What was the top population of Gitmo at its height? Do you know?
Oh, I'm terrible with numbers. It's right above or under 800 in
okay.
all, but I don't remember exactly.
But speaking of Guantanamo, let's go back to Cuba in the 1890s. What was happening at the time, and who was General Valeriano Weyler y Nicolai?
We can just call him by his nickname, which was the Butcher. He was sent in when the very beginning of concentration camp history. There was a governor in charge of the island who decided the only way to fight these rebels who wanted independence from Spain, and we're talking in Cuba at the time, they wanted to be independent from Spain, was to round up all the peasants out of the countryside, and then anyone who was left in the countryside would be an insurgent and you could shoot them. And he thought that would be the only way that it would be possible to defeat them. But he refused to do it as a representative of what he saw as a civilized nation. And so they recalled him, and they sent in General Weyler, who you mentioned, whose nickname was the Butcher. And the Butcher basically decided that he would only go if he were given a completely free hand to do what he wanted to do. And so there was a lot of horrific killing, and there were detentions of more than 300,000 Cuban peasants, and approximately 150,000 of them are believed to have died. So it was basically an early kind of genocide, not because they were slaughtering them in the camps, but because the camps were so hastily put together and so ill-equipped with any kind of hygiene or food that people just died in droves.
How would those camps in the 1890s in Cuba compare with, again, what most people think of as a concentration camp in Europe in the 1930s and 40s?
Well, there's this first decade of camps were like the ones I just described in Cuba, where they were generally colonial powers were fighting independence movements inside the countries and resorted to these kinds of camps. But the path that you get from that first decade to the camps people think of with barracks and barbed wire and machine guns and is through World War One, which was that camp use was almost entirely abandoned before World War One, but during World War One, everybody resuscitated it, and civilian camps existed on six continents. So you went in just 4 or 5 year period from having almost no camps to a bureaucracy of camp detentions all around the world with Red Cross routing letters and sending observers, and it kind of humanized this idea that had been seen as quite barbaric. But it's like, oh, yes, you could just intern people, and that would be a perfectly reasonable thing to do. And so I think that those World War One camps were really instrumental in making it seem normal when the gulag began to rise in Soviet Russia and the first Nazi camps appeared.
Let's go back to the turn of the 20th century, though. You talked about skipping ahead to World War One, but I think most people, when they picture concentration camps, they think that these are things that are done by created by real bad people that, you know, think Nazi Germany, and I know real bad people is an understatement, but turn of the century in Southern Africa, the Boer Wars, the British actually set up concentration camps.
They did. One of the things I found writing the book was that any political system is vulnerable to this. It is not just something that, when we think of totalitarian states or police states, it doesn't have to be that kind of state to do it. Usually those kinds of states, particularly democracies, have institutions that put the brakes on it sooner and limit the worst outcomes. So definitely you see a difference in how it plays out. But every country is really vulnerable to this, and we see that in the Boer War with the British. They were having a very difficult time dealing with these guerrilla fighters, again, out in the countryside, who could sort of disappear at will, and were being aided in some cases by their spouses or other Boer descendants of Dutch settlers who were fighting them, by their wives or children who could give them food or hide them for periods of time. So the answer became to burn down all the crops, burn down all their homes, and force the women and children out. And it was a kind of a dual thing. It was to deprive them of food and shelter, but it was also to sort of have, they weren't torturing them or doing anything terrible to the women and children in a direct way, but it was sort of understood that there was a kind of an implicit hostage situation there as well.
You write about many different examples of concentration camps over the years. You mentioned the Soviet Gulag, China during the Cold War, North Korea during the Cold War, probably continuing even today in North Korea. But I do want to talk about Nazi Germany and Europe during World War II. Whose idea in the Third Reich was it? And what was their intention to set up concentration camps?
Well, we see Hitler talking very, very early on that his enemies, enemies of the Nazi Party, should learn what it feels like to be in a concentration camp. And he's doing that in the early 20s. We see that, you know, long before they take power. And that is part of what I was talking about of the relic of the camps of World War One. He was already thinking of these internment camps that had been used against Germans, and some Germans were kept in them because Germany lost long after the war. They weren't released right away, and this was something that had incensed Hitler and had been a grievance. So I think the idea that these would then be used on the Nazis' enemies was there from the very beginning. And you see Dachau being reconstituted as a permanent camp. They were already, by a few weeks after Hitler came to power as chancellor, there were already improvised camps that were going on, but even in within a couple months, you've got determination that Dachau is going to be this permanent camp. So it happens very early on, but it isn't until around 1938-39 that the camps become kind of the heart of this new strategy that will become the final solution.
It wasn't just Jews at first, was it? I mean, you mentioned Gypsies or Roma. They seemed to be especially annoying to Hitler and Nazis.
Well, and this is another important thing to look at how concentration camps unfold. In those first years, some of the Nazi camp pattern is very similar to what we see other places. Of course, it becomes quite different later. But at first, it's to get their political opponents. You know, it's the communist deputies and the people who are opposing their attempt to lock in power permanently. And so you have a whole bunch of communist deputies who are rounded up in this little town of Nora, which is often seen as the very first concentration camp. They even let them go vote the first week of March that year, 1933. And so this little tiny town of Nora has this incredibly out-of-whack communist vote from that session, because they're pretending like it's all like it was during World War One at first, that this is reasonable detention, that they're just holding them on suspicion, that everything else is normal. And in fact, it goes down this path where it goes from being their political opponents to then being people they want off the streets, so homeless, gypsies, people seen as vagrants, anyone that's sort of thwarting their overall plans. You see homosexuals then detained. This is definitely not part of the Aryan program. But Jews as a whole group, certainly Jews ended up with very bad treatment before this in the camps, but being targeted, German Jews being targeted, doesn't really happen until Kristallnacht in 1939, and even after, 1938. And even after that, many of them are released. It's 1939 that you start to see the way we think of the camps really begin to unfold.
When did the final solution come about?
Well, its approaches for how you kill a whole bunch of people most efficiently had been worked on in various camps with various populations, including Soviet POWs and others, for a while. But there's at the Wannsee Conference, you know, there's this decision to move this direction, that in fact the idea of maybe putting all the Jews, the Polish Jews, on reservation somewhere and forcing them to work, that these are just not feasible, and that extermination is going to be where it goes. There's still a lot of debate over exactly how we get to that moment, but what we know is that in 1942 we have this massive shift, and this whole layer of camps that is built on top of the existing concentration camp system, and then those are the death camps. And most of the death camps do not function as regular concentration camps, but Auschwitz, the most famous perhaps of all concentration camps, plays both roles. It is both the traditional system and becomes then this death camp machine.
Let's take a phone call from Egan in Lancaster. Egan, you're on the air.
Hi. My question is, recently there's been a law passed in Poland, and the law states that no one is allowed to involve Polish citizens in the concentration camps at Auschwitz. And it's getting criticized all over the world. I'd like to know what your guest's opinion about this new law that outlaws any statements about Polish citizens.
Thank you for your call, Egan.
So what the law says, there's kind of two pieces to it that are really important, and one is that you're not allowed to use the phrase Polish death camps, and Poland reasonably has some sensitivity on this issue because it was occupied Poland, the Nazis swept in, it was definitely a Nazi camp system that was established, so it was the Nazis who were running this camp system, and the Poles often, because the territory was occupied Poland, they often get saddled with this phrase, and it, you know, can give the impression that somehow the Polish government approved of all this. So that's a reasonable concern the Poles have. Outlawing it, I don't think, is the appropriate response. But the deeper issue that I think most people are upset about, that's very problematic in this law, is that it appears to restrict the public ability of people in Poland to talk about the role that Polish citizens might have played in some of this. So we know it was not created by the Polish government. It was not created as a Polish enterprise. But on the ground level, where there were killings, where there were pogroms, where there were reprisals taken against Jewish people and other people in the community, the fact that some Poles were involved in this is very fraught and contested history that's still being worked out today. It's not settled at all. So it's very important that we can look at this honestly and see to what degree did some Polish citizens play a role in what happened with these with the Holocaust? And go ahead.
I was going to say, we have another call from a listener. Linda in Hummelstown said, what about the internment camps of Japanese Americans during World War II? Consider it a concentration camp?
Yes, I absolutely would consider it a concentration camp. And it's a good example of the ways in which, even when democracies screw up, as they did, most of the people in these camps were American citizens. I mean, that's just like locking you or me up. That's just as ridiculous. That even in that case, there were some institutions that came to bear. It did go to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court in Korematsu, a very famous case, actually approved of it, but they still couldn't quite square the detention. It was this very convoluted argument. And then there was a later case where they just decided you just couldn't lock all these people up this way, and it was then part of the trigger that began to release them, in fact, before the end of the war.
Mm-hmm. Just one final question. You say there's never been a time in the last 100 years when the world hasn't had a concentration camp. Where are others today or in the last decade or so?
The most prominent example of, I think, what people would classically see as camps now is in Myanmar, which used to be known as Burma, and it's the Rohingya Muslim population that has been held there since 2012 after some intercommunal violence. And they were originally sort of held there as refugees. Their homes had been burned down, but they were never let go. I sneaked into those camps in 2015, and since then we have seen the country move against not so much the people in those camps, but the similar population, the Rohingya, the same population north of there. And it's very disturbing that they're still held in these camps. They're very vulnerable to what appears to have many of the hallmarks of ethnic cleansing going on right now in Southeast Asia.
Andrea Pitzer is author of the book One Long Night, A Global History of Concentration Camps, a great read. Andrea Pitzer appears at Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg this Saturday at 3:30 p.m. Ms. Pitzer, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. WITF's multimedia news director Tim Lambert joins me now, and Tim has a lot lighter topic to discuss and a lot happier anyway. Tim, it's the Roses campaign. Big time of year for WITF, and it's our listeners.
It's a huge time of year, and it looks like that we were doing great so far this morning. We're just getting an update on the big board, but we are up to 85 gifts at last check, and a lot of different states were receiving roses because this is the last day up until 2 o'clock. This is your last chance on Smart Talk to support the program that you hear each and every day, but also to send roses in support of the program and that certain someone in your life across the nation. So you can go to WITF.org/roses, or you can call 1-800-233-9483. And if you listen to Smart Talk and you maybe have attended a few of the Smart Talk road trips where you have had a chance to watch the show live, maybe you're thinking about going to the one in Pittsburgh that's coming
right
up. That's going to be a fun one.
Yeah, next Tuesday, we're going to be at the Heinz History Center in Pittsburgh. Actually, there's a bus trip where we're celebrating, if you will, Mr. Rogers' 50th anniversary of Mr. Rogers' start of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood program, and there's still room on the bus. Go to WITF.org/events, and we'd love to see you there next Tuesday.
Yeah, and you can also you can get those tickets, but first, make sure you send roses and support WITF at 1-800-233-9483 or WITF.org/roses. And national delivery cutoff is at 2 p.m. today, so if you want to send it, Florida's been a popular state today. I think we have about a half dozen, maybe more, orders heading to Florida. We've seen orders go to Vermont, Massachusetts, California, New York, Minnesota, and also Virginia. West Virginia still lonely, still no roses headed to anybody in West Virginia from
Central
PA.
Yeah, what's up with the Mountaineers this year?
I don't know what's happening. I don't know what's happening.
We actually have
Alaska
some...
Hawaii now are checking in, so this is fantastic.
Ontario and Prince Edward Island in Canada,
yeah,
as well. One thing you probably noticed, we don't mention names. We want to thank everyone who has participated, purchased some roses for a loved one or someone that they're thinking about, but we wanted to be a surprise, so mentioning no names.
All I can say is Lancaster is sending roses to Alaska. That is all I will say about that. But North Carolina's on the list now, Scott. This is great. Delaware, Virginia, and we talked about Florida a lot. So more than 85 gifts right now to WITF at 1-800-233-9483 or online at WITF.org/roses.
Thank you very much, Tim.
Sure.
And again, last day for those roses to be sent out of state. So take advantage.
It's World Radio Day.
It is a real and Fastnacht Day, and tomorrow's Ash Wednesday. There's a lot going on over the next few days. Thanks very much, Tim.
Sure.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, is redistricting being done to fairly represent race? We'll be talking about that tomorrow. Big issue here in Pennsylvania right now.
Smart Talk is produced by WITF as part of our mission to deliver relevant, high-quality programming. Support comes from Capital Blue Cross, which shares WITF's commitment to being a trusted resource in our communities. Capital Blue Cross, live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by UPMC Pinnacle, who is studying a new surgical technique that allows surgeons to make repairs to the heart without having to open the chest cavity and while the heart is beating. Info at upmcpinnacle.com.